It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Strap on your parachute. It's time for What Goes Up with Sarah Ponczek and Mike Regan.
Hello, and welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Ponczek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor at Bloomberg. And you can think of me as the Clyde to Sarah's Bonnie.
You knew that Mike had to come with a sidekick this week because he was called out on Twitter a couple of times by some of our dedicated listeners.
I know. Once you start a gimmick like that, there's no turning back. You got to keep going with it.
No turning back. But this week on the show, considering Mike and I are both based in the U.S., our guests usually are too. So this week, we are absolutely thrilled to get the perspective of someone overseas. Our guest this week is actually out in Sydney, Australia, and back in March, his Asia-focused macro strategy fund ended the month up more than 16%.
And as always, we'll close out the episode with our tradition, the craziest thing I saw in markets this week. And by all means, if you see something crazy, then give us a call at the Bloomberg podcast hotline, 646-324-3490, and leave us a message and maybe we'll play it on the show. And Sarah, like you said, our guest this week, first time on the show, really interesting career history. He started out at Credit Suisse. He worked at Morgan Stanley for a while. Then he spent several years at the big famous hedge fund shop, Brevan Howard, before going out on his own, founding his own hedge fund called Reminiscent Capital. And he is the chief investment officer and founder of that firm. His name is David Adams. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me here. I should qualify that that performance was over Q1. So I'd love to have made that all in 1 month, but that was over the course of the month. But thank you for the introduction.
Yeah. So let me see if I got this right. Q1 was up about 16.5%. But really outperformed the S&P by like 21, 22% in March and outperformed in February by 14%. Do I have those numbers in the right ballpark there?
Yeah, that's right. Those gross numbers, that's correct. This is my fourth crisis, so I've been through a few of these things.
We'll break it down.
Third time's the charm, fourth time you get it right, right?
Yeah, that's right.
I know. That's I keep right. hearing people saying after the last financial crisis, I never thought I'd live for another one. It's crazy. But we'll just, you know, break it down for us if you can. Give us some insight on some of the trades, some of the decisions you made to put up those really impressive numbers during all of this.
Sure. We'll do. I mean, you know, one thing to sort of a roundabout way to answer that is before I even launch into that is, I'm glad I started, humbled and kind of honored that I've been able to start a fund. And, you know, I'm so glad that I'm in my 40s and got a little bit of gray hair because your experience really does matter. And if I, you know, sort of I laughed about it, but if you look at this, this is actually, you know, my fourth crisis. And when you've been through, you know, a few of them, if you look at this one, while they're all a little bit different, there is a pattern. And I was lucky enough to be, you know, I was in London when, you know, at that time it was very interesting. You had very low vol, you had lots of leverage, and people were moving away from directional and basically saying, you know, why would you take directional risk when you can put on, you know, a mean reversion strategy in like 10 times the size? And so back then, you know, what was happening is people were moving more and more away from proprietary, more and more towards quant. And of course, what typified that was, you know, the guys that wrote the book on option pricing, it was long-term capital management. And, you know, who would question them? You'd been to university and learned from their books. Their hedge fund was preeminent, long-term capital. Their returns were 35 and then 40 and then 55%. And of course, as the system often does, it corrects. And it was pretty spectacular. And what happened there was, as they imploded, you know, $1.4 trillion exposure got bailed out by the Fed. But what I remember witnessing the most on a 200-person trading floor in London was, you know, right when you need it most, especially in a leveraged portfolio, portfolio theory doesn't work. People just had to get out. And so things like that at the start of my career really left an important... It means I could, with confidence, kind of look at anyone through the rest of my career and say, I don't care kind of what you have to say about what could potentially happen, your potential correlation offset. You know, I want to know what is the max dollars and cents I can lose or an investor can lose. So why I digressed with that preamble was that what experiences like that taught me was that, and I was very lucky to learn from some great folks, is that, you know, when these things come about, there's a pattern. And so, you know, we have like a five-step process. And what happens is there's a huge amount of informational value in the front end of the dollar curve. You know, if you think about it, 80% of the world's debt is in dollars. And so that dollar market, especially the front end of the curve, you know, really knows what's going on pretty much before anything else. And what's also really interesting, one of the kind of edges of sort of what we do, is that, interestingly, the dollar bot complex, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the US, for whatever reasons, and part of that is geographical, part of that is because we have much, much more simple mortgage markets. If you look at Australia and New Zealand, you know, our banks predominantly fund in the US market. So a lot of our housing market is funded by, you know, Australian banks doing US CP and US debt in the US markets. So we start to get a sense of funding pressure quite early. It's a bit of a warning sign out here in Asia through those markets. What's more is if it's come from China, if it's a coronavirus that's on our doorstep, you know, we started to see it spreading from cities getting shut down in China to tourism and such getting affected over here. And then our funding markets start to pick that up. It meant that you could do the following. That gave us the signal that there was going to be a problem. And the five-step process is, the playbook for these crises is you do rates. So just quickly to run through, it's bonds. So you do rates, you know, front-end trades, bonds, and bonds. And then you do vol, so you'll buy some FX vol or some equity vol. And then you go into downsides across FX, you know, Aussie yen, Kiwi yen, Nikkei, S&P 500. And then as by this stage, rates have really started to move, vol's picking up, and equity markets are starting to crack. And then you go into credit. It was amazing to us, even about 3 weeks in, equities are off sort of 15%, you know, give or take, and the credit markets have barely moved. Now, we're not a credit fund, but we do credit proxies. So things like swap spreads, FRAOS wideners. So you've done bonds, you've done vol, you do downside trades, and then you do credit trades. And then as you saw towards the end of the moves, you get phenomenally large days, both up and down, 12% down days in equities. The long end of the bond market moves sort of 50%. And the trade you do there is then the margin trade. And this is quite staggering, because what happens is when that vol episode occurs, the first one we all know about, equity markets raise exchange margins, you know, people get margined and you have to post US dollars. Again, most margin in the world is in US dollars. But the thing people don't see as much of, when you've been in a bank, you really understand this. To an extent, especially a rates hedge fund as well. Those 50, 60 bit moves in the long end of US curves, Aussie curves, sterling curves, mean that all the big cross currency swap books around the world, all the banks have got huge mark to markets, and they physically have to come up with dollars. So if you're National Australia Bank, you've got to come up with $131.5 million to pay JP Morgan T plus two. So that's where assets get sold. That's why gold comes off. That's why assets get sold. And then currencies get sold. They then have to go and sell Aussie dollar, sell Korean won to raise US to post that margin. So we had margin trades on them, and they tend to work very quickly. And then after that, you want to get out. You want to sweep all of your investors' money safely to kind of a safe shore, a custodian, or your PB. So that's a sort of a five-step thing that if you look through the last few crises, that kind of works, you know, in varying forms time and time again. So we're lucky enough to have learned that. And that's kind of just the playbook we rolled out.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It almost sounds like a domino effect, and it's fascinating, but when was it actually? I'm really curious when you guys started picking up on stress through funding markets. I mean, it almost seems as though the reaction was delayed in the US. Obviously, you had the virus coming out of China, then it spread through Asia, it spread through Europe, it made its way over to the US, but we didn't feel it until a couple months into the year. I mean, when was it that you started actually picking up on this?
Right. The process we have is essentially, there's three steps I can go through a little bit later, but the first part of that, when we look for a change in narrative. So you look for a change in narrative, and there, you know, you want to be, you know, fairly kind of humble and open-minded to all of your avenues. So we'll look at micro data, look at macro data, we'll look at price data, we talk to our network, you know, you have to look out the window as well sometimes. And then where Reminiscence is a little bit different another lens we have, is hence the name, we quite often look through historical precedent, historic analogs, you're going further back than just the sort of 5-7 year business cycle. I know in one of your podcasts, actually, you used that word several times, reminiscent. I think you guys have had one in June where you were talking about the sort of the market meltdown. That word came up a lot. But where I'm going with this, when we were looking through the process of those different avenues, it was very clear. Some of those things were, if you look at just the sort of macro data, you know, it was dramatic. Entire cities shut down, flights, etc. So it was ticking a lot of the boxes. I think a lot of people were kind of almost in denial because you weren't getting the confirmation just yet with regards to price action. So some staggering things happening, but the market was very benign. So for us, I think, you know, one of the things that sort of really started to tip us over was, once again, back to our roots, was that first step in the process was where fixed income was starting to crack. And it was also the nature by which it was cracking. So what you find, it's very interesting to us, is when you find, for example, the front end prices, the volumes and how they're trading. So if you have like 10,000, for example, on the bid and 1,000 on the offer, and it gets taken, and then there's another 10,000 on the bid, and offers just keep getting taken. So it's, if you like, the distribution of heavy hands wanting to own those contracts with no pullbacks. It's just one input, but the market is telling you something. When you've got this very, very kind of unrelenting, heavy-handed, you know, offers getting lifted, very, very, very kind of strong base to a fixed income market across quite a few markets. So you were seeing it in New Zealand, you're seeing Australia, seeing it in the US all at the same time, coupled with all those other factors, started to really kind of prick my attention. So little clues like that just can sometimes be the tipping point over and above kind of a robust process underneath it. And so once we saw that, it became interesting to us to then, you know, roll out some of these trades. And of course, what we then do is you start with the most skewed trades, where if you're wrong, it's not going to be a problem. And that was front-end fixed income. There were some fantastic trades where you were, to give you an example, we put on across about four different countries, where you're risking about a basis point to make 25 to 50. Even if you were wrong, you know, you weren't losing too much.
You know, Sarah, he makes it sound easy. I as David says, he's in his 40s with gray hair. I'm in my 40s with gray hair, but I don't have these type of returns to talk about or this type of this type of experience to leverage. But, you know, David, a lot of what you're describing is, you know, that reaction, that real funding stress in the short end of the curve, very on in sort of the cross asset volatility we saw. I guess, you know, from your experience, and any observer would guess that, well, the Fed was going to step in soon, right, and solve what it can with these massive liquidity injections we've seen, you know, a variety of stuff. Walk us through how you were thinking about that. You must have known the Fed was about to come in big. And was it just a matter of getting in and out quick before that happens? Or do you even sort of tempt fate and wait for the announcement? Or is it too late by then once the Fed starts rolling out these programs?
Good question. Great question. I've got an interesting anecdote. I'm not sure if it's appropriate for this show, but I'm going to do it anyway.
We'll take anything on this show. We're easygoing.
My interesting anecdote for you is as follows. At that time, it was actually interesting because I forget the name of the Fed speaker, but at that time, the Fed, this is very kind of early on, and who's to blame them? It wasn't obvious to them at that stage. It wasn't obvious to anyone really at that stage in its full entirety, but the Fed actually came out with, you know, we're not going to be doing anything. We're not going to move rates. this is very, very early in the piece, before equities had really started to move too much, that they actually announced, you know, we have no intention to move interest rates. And I think it was pretty much that next morning, you know, my daughters have got these little bunny rabbits, and the little bunny rabbits, they tend to chew all my books. So we had some books down in the lower shelf, which have subsequently been moved to the higher shelves. But Mr. Bunny, we call him Mr. Bunny, Mr. Bunny had gone and to his book for that night, he'd torn apart. I came up the next, woke up the next morning, torn apart the book, and I looked down. I'm staring straight at Mr. Greenspan, and it was the age of...
If there is a sign, that is a sign.
Yeah, this is not how we invested, by the way. We were already positioned. But look, I did do a few extra contracts, I will admit. But so I looked, I'm staring at Mr. Bunny, I'm staring at Mr. Greenspan, and it was the age of turbulence, and I remember reading that book a couple of times, many years before, actually. And, you know, I think it was one of the pieces in that book where Greenspan himself talked about how, you know, central bankers will guide us in a certain direction, you know, for a long period of time. And then when it is time to turn, they turn very quickly. And so part of that anecdote was, it was a little bit humorous to see that book, but it did make me think a little bit about what was in those chapters. And, you know, funny enough, it turned out that the Fed, you know, 7 days later, emergency cut 50. So you really didn't get the proper warnings from them, not to blame, not to point fingers in any way, shape or form. But, you know, again, if you've been around long enough, you know, when you've been around long enough, you know, they don't know themselves. And you have to remember that they can turn very quick, and they have a precedent of doing that. And that's also the right thing for the Fed to do, to give us confidence until such time as, you know, it's time to then to go the other. And it's very, very important for the likes of the Fed. To then, you know, once they've decided that something is afoot, to then change quickly and be very forceful on that change, because that then instills in us that they're, you know, they're there on the job and they're paying attention to it and they're coming in to help.
So do you buy when they say that they won't go negative then? Is that something that you guys have to seriously think about? Or are you waiting for another sign from your daughter's bunnies on that one?
That's right.
We want the bunny on the next podcast, I think, sir. We'll give him a bunch of books to chew through. Right. See if, you know, Graham and Dodd, we'll give him whatever it takes.
Well, actually, I've got one I'll show you in a minute. I've got the best 100 internet stocks to own, which I bought after the dot-com crash. There's a lovely page in there called Amazon, and it talks about, you know, we think this business might work out.
We think.
Yeah, yeah. So as a $2.50 that book cost. So, yeah, your question was negative rates, et cetera, et cetera. So my thoughts on that are that anything that's being said currently, you know, all bets are off. They can easily change their mind. What do I think in that regard? The market's kind of telling us something there as well a little bit. If you look at already the likes of the sterling market, you know, starting to go negative, et cetera, et cetera. Let's look at the elasticity. We've had, since the March lows over the past 4 months, a very substantial equity rally, and rates have barely been able to move higher. That tells me elasticity to kind of bad news, et cetera, et cetera. The market will, I think, price or force kind of at least a pricing for negative rates in a lot of countries, including the US. Whether the Fed does or they doesn't is probably a tough question. And there's obviously some plumbing issues, and there's a lot of important stuff to get your head around as to whether that's actually a good or a bad thing and how that gets implemented. But as far as making money for our investors goes, the market will almost certainly price for it if we get a very bad kind of vol event, equity markets going down. And there's some very skewed payout trades that you can have on to benefit from that. So I think that the market will certainly price for it. And I suspect that you can make money off of that. Whether they actually do or they don't is probably a little bit more complicated than a lot of other countries. Just as you all know, that, you know, dollars being the reserve currency of the world comes with a bit more issues than maybe some of the smaller open economies. So that's what I would say is I think we can make money for investors on that. Will they end up doing it? Not sure. I suspect they probably would if things got very bad.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, when you sort of survey the landscape of Asia, where are you seeing some good opportunities? You know, is the sort of tempest of political back and forth between the U.S. and China a major risk for China, or are you sort of looking through that?
Sure. So the opportunities we sort of see in the next 6 months, I'm quite excited. I think there's a lot to talk about. But if we just nut down to maybe one or two things that are simple to describe, if you look at the pendulum of risk with regard to that equity rally we've spoken about, you know, there's a lot of the internals will show you with regard to price data, daily sentiment, you know, moving averages, positioning, all the Robin Hood sort of anecdotes, et cetera, et cetera. A sort of telling someone like myself, it's getting quite full. It's probably starting to get towards the point where it probably needs some sort of pullback and maybe some sort of correction. But, you know, trying to pick that is a dangerous game. So we're not going to do that. So we're not going to try and pick some sort of top in equities. So instead we say, okay, you know, given that, you know, how can one make money for investors? And it's as follows. As I described earlier, rates have not been able to go higher at all, despite all of that. And kind of experience tells us that should you get any turn down in that pendulum, rates probably start to price lower. So what we've done is we've put on, you know, a portfolio of some trades in front ends of various curves, whereby you've got very little you're risking of investor capital that any other scenario, you know, a moderate downturn in risk, a medium downturn or a large downturn in risk, you're going to have commensurate P&L for investors in sort of front end rates. So we've got those on. I suspect they probably don't do a lot. Maybe they decay out and die. We're not risking too much capital on those. But should you get any of those other three outcomes, which I think the probability of at least some sort of blip between now and year end is reasonable, let alone maybe a reasonable move higher in vol and risk. So I think that's the first step. I think you're supposed to have those sorts of trades on, number one. Number two would be with regard to sort of China and the US, et cetera, et cetera. It's been interesting to see that if you look at the Chinese with trade getting trickier and trickier for them with various countries around the world, with their economy slowing down, and with it being, you know, increasingly hard for them to continue to prop up property markets and infrastructure. Well, infrastructure they can, but the property market, you know, that, it leaves them with, and it's been exciting to see this past month, their equity market. You know, they can effectively weaponize their equity market, or maybe that's an aggressive word. They can really kind of try and help support, you know, consumer confidence and et cetera, by keeping their equity market very well supported and essentially trying to engineer a US-style equity rally. And the thing about the Chinese is two things. One is they've still got 300 basis points out there in the 10 years of rates that they can collapse down to zero. And this day and age, you've seen from what happened in the rest of the world, that's a huge amount of PE expansion and kind of support they can provide through collapsing rates over time. And of course, just the Chinese themselves and the retail community there, you know, they can do a rally like no one else. I think you could see a bit of a handover where you get Chinese equities doing quite well relative to US. And maybe, you know, especially for a portfolio that wants to maybe be a bit defensive, that could potentially actually come about through, at some stage, the US equities coming off and China maybe not even coming off, maybe even rallying over the medium term. So I wouldn't be completely surprised if 18 months from now, we find that US equities are maybe here or lower, possibly, you know, a lot lower, and Chinese equities are here or higher. And that's, you know, we're earmarking, you could maybe have as much as, you know, north of a 50% move in that sort of relative performance. So that's kind of exciting to us before we even need to kind of go into Trump-China tensions and the election. That we think is kind of interesting. And that firepower that the Chinese have got in their kind of rates, if you just look at the rest of the world, just roll out that playbook in the rest of the world. And it's, you know, people have been able to do it in Europe, they've done it in the UK, they've done it in the US. And it's kind of there for the taking in China if the Chinese want to. So we're watching that really carefully.
Do you even bother trying to predict U.S.-China relations and Trump and the outcome of the election? I mean, I think about when we were going through phase one trade talks, so you knew what we were moving towards. But now all of a sudden, it seems like the possibilities are much more up in the air. And you hear the U.S. talk about sanctions or retaliation or whatever it might be. But it seems like the playing field is much larger right now.
Right. Yeah. So the way we look at it is we come from the Asian lens. So if you look at, say, last year, even as a good anecdote, you know, there's some fantastic folks out there. There's a lot of great research firms, you know, trying to compete with other funds on getting an edge on the US election. I think is foolhardy for us. We're a fairly small firm in terms of headcount and still capital at this stage because we're growing. So what we did is we go completely other side. We look at the Asian perspective, and there, if you take a bit of time and you've, you know, reasonable network, or you just even listen to the authorities and the central banks in Asia, the Japanese and the Chinese, they're very good at telegraphing and telling you what they're intending to do, and you should listen to it. Very often I found, being out in Sydney and when I worked in Hong Kong, you'd have offshore investors would quite often sort of try and be a little bit too cute and sort of counter trade the domestic markets, and you're really supposed to listen to them. So if you look at last year, was an example where the Chinese were starting to describe to us, both, you know, publicly and through think tanks, and if you were just to read what they were saying, you know, they were explaining how, I mean, even I was staggered at the time, you know, sort of around June, as it were, if you spoke to sort of some think tanks and your sort of Chinese network, you know, they actually had a name for it. They were talking about a staircase depreciation for CNH. This was back over a year ago. By staircase, they meant allow dollar CNH to go higher, you know, hold it in. They don't want capital flight, so they hold it in and then allow it to go higher. So it looks like a staircase. So it had a name, you kind of had a timing window, you kind of had the trade laid out. And of course, sure enough, in August, dollar CNH did exactly that, exploded up towards 720, was held in, et cetera, et cetera. So what I'm trying to say there is that we come more from the Asian lens and listen to what they're saying and some of the guidelines. It's far less looked at, you know, kind of far more opportunities and far less granular than the US market. So instead of us trying to compete in that sphere, we come from that Asian perspective.
Does the messaging out of China seem a little mixed to you these days? You know, I remember, I guess it was, I don't know, in mid late June when there was a state media editorial out of China basically suggesting that the government was looking to help the equity market sort of enter a bull phase, and sure enough, that Chinese equities just went crazy there for a few weeks. Now they're coming back off of the boil a little bit. You know, how in control of the equity market do you think is the signaling from Chinese state media? And what would they do to sort of cool it off? I mean, is it a sort of suppress the margin accounts in the country, or is it more of an open mouth operation type of thing where they would sort of suggest, you know, some sort of restrictions on security firms that would cool things off?
You know, when you look at Asia, you've got to have that slightly different lens. Asian markets just are that much higher vol. And so if you send process after this, I can send you a great chart. If you come back with a slightly reminiscent, you know, wider lens, a bit more of a historical precedent, give yourself more of a wider lens. If you look at the Shanghai comp, it's a great chart I can send you. The move we've started, it looks like a lot, but the move we've started to have, even before, you know, last night, the pullbacks we've had recently, it's a blip. In terms of the larger moves that we've had. So if you take at face value that you're potentially going to see on a relative basis anyway, like an engineering of an appreciation in their market, it's really only just beginning, number one. And so number two is when we do see these quite significant pullbacks, you know, 6, 7, 8% pullbacks, you know, just give yourself some breathing room that kind of in their eyes, in the Chinese investors' kind of eyes, unlike, say, a U.S. market, especially the past few months where the U.S. market being very sort of tame in terms of daily moves, allow yourself much more breathing room. So I think that we can potentially see a decent appreciation in equities. With regard to your specific comments on how they can cool and manage that, I think they've gotten a lot better since 2014 and 15. And it is exactly what you described. It's various levers like margin accounts, you know, potentially encouraging some of the larger, you know, kind of almost like state-owned firms, but certainly like the very, very kind of in the loop, large money managers that kind of know when they're going to put the accelerator and the brakes on to kind of work with what they call the national team. And of course, the national team themselves, you know, kind of buying and selling. I think they will be better at managing some of the volatility that was present in 2015. But even there, I think, especially if the market gets very exuberant to the upside, they'll still have their hands full.
It's almost like a different world.
Yeah.
But Mike, I really do wish that we could talk for hours and hours more. I know you're just starting your morning over in Sydney, so I know you'd be able to. But I think it's that time, Mike.
Yeah, that's pretty good for early morning, David. I'm not ever that coherent
at what is it, 6 or 7 in the morning as you are. So very impressive. We'll have to have you back sometime when the world's back to normal and talk again. But as Sarah said, well, let's let Charlie Pellett tell us what time it is.
Stand clear of the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
All right, Sarah, let's start with you. What is the craziest thing you saw in markets this week?
All right, well, this might be an obvious one, but I have to go with the Twitter hack that we saw. I mean, a Twitter hack, first of all, just for a Bitcoin scam, but the breadth and the amount of accounts that we saw on Twitter hacked. I mean, you're talking about Obama, you're talking about Biden, Warren Buffett, Elon Musk, Kanye West, who, by the way, did end his presidential bid, I have to say, because we mentioned it on one of the recent episodes. But just the idea that someone is so almost easily able to get access to such high-profile accounts is amazing, and it makes you think about what else they could have done if they wanted to.
Yeah, it is pretty crazy and scary and very scary.
And scary, very scary. I mean, Bitcoin scam, supposedly they raised about $120,000, but I'd imagine that the damage that they could have done could have been way worse than that.
David, that's a good question. Does a guy like you even think about Bitcoin? Is that just a lane you'd stay out of?
So with regards to crypto and Bitcoin, one thing I would say is that when you look at these sorts of crises that we've had, you know, through history, very often the authorities will kind of throw scraps at the mob. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I think it's somewhat disgusting that we'll probably come out of this and the top 1 or 10% will be even richer. So what they do to keep kind of things, if you look at disposable income in the US, it's actually gone up, and that's these cash handouts. But what happens, you know, once they kind of quell the initial fire, what happens is you look a little bit further down the pipe, you probably in certain countries around to pay for all this, you might start to see things like a one-off wealth tax, inheritance taxes going up. So the super wealthy want to start getting some of their money off the grid. And so I could actually see a very big move in things like some of the cryptos like Bitcoin as people want to take some incoming years, get a little bit of money off the grid to avoid some of these taxes. So I could see a very, very large rally potentially. Fundamentals and all that sort of stuff, and you know, trying to get the fundamentals and all that sort of stuff, I think is not what I would get into. But I could see that from that perspective, yes.
No, you have to think shady when you think Bitcoin, and I think that's the absolute right way to approach it. That's pretty fascinating, Sarah. I'm gonna remember that.
If we see a big
Bitcoin rally, I think that
when Bitcoin starts surging like 4 years from now, I'll be like, oh, remember that time that we talked to David about people wanting to get their money offshore.
Yeah, but just one thing just on that, because there are some, you know, hard-working men and women in crypto. So I think, you know, as much like the internet 20 years ago is, and maybe Bitcoin is one of them, but if you look at, like, you know, is cryptocurrency and digital assets, you know, is that very sensible and can that be very efficient going forward? Yeah, I mean, some of this stuff, you know, the banks are thinking about adopting for payment systems and all that sort of stuff. So I don't have any issues with digital currencies. Just to qualify there, that, you know, my comment there was that there might be some elements of people wanting to go off grid, but there might be some bona fide kind of benefits of digital currency, et cetera.
Yeah, he's being much more diplomatic about it than me. My Twitter's probably going to get hacked instantly after this episode. But anyway, but how about David? Have you seen anything crazy in markets this week?
Not really. Look, the only thing I'll say was in preparing for this podcast was listening to a few of the ones you folks had done. Was, I forget the name, I should recall it, but one of your fund managers, I think a CIO, was mentioning that he was that close to just putting down his whole process and all his research, putting on a pair of shoes and getting his shoes shined to figure out the stock tip or what the market's doing, because he seems to think that his 21-year-old's making more money than he is.
That's true.
So that might tell you where we are in the cycle.
I'd get my shoe shined, but sorry, I left all my good shoes at work. I leave them in under my desk at work and I wear sneakers to work. So I'd have to get like my flip-flops.
I'm also not sure. Would you be able to go get your shoes shined anyways, even if you did have your shoes nowadays?
Probably not. I'll have to go get my flip-flops shined next week, I guess. But that's a good one, David. All right, I'll give you my craziest thing. Sarah, as you know, I like to sort of bend the asset classes we're talking about, expand them into. And I'm a big fan of the art market. Not that I really know anything about the art market. And I'm no expert in the art market, but I am an expert on crazy things. So the art market, it contains plenty of those.
It's easy to find crazy.
Absolutely. And again, no expert here, but one of my favorite artists in the world is this guy Banksy. Have you heard of this guy Banksy? Very great sense of humor on this guy. He sold a painting of the British Parliament, except they were all portrayed as monkeys. He sold that one last year for like $12 million.
They have wigs on?
No wigs. I don't think they did ever. Maybe I'll have to go back and look at it. I don't think so, though. But good sense of humor. So this past week, what he did, and the guy started out as a street artist, tagging walls and subways and that sort of thing. So this week he snuck onto the London Underground and graffitied up the inside of a London subway car with a bunch of pictures of rats. And they were like, it was meant to give a message about the virus and how you should wear a mask. So some of the mice, I guess, were either holding masks or wearing them. And then he scrawled the words, "I get locked down" on one train door, and then you open it up and it says, "But I get up again." Anyway, so here's a guy. This subway car, I don't know, David, but you put this up for auction in Connecticut or somewhere in London. This subway car, I would love to know what it would go for. Probably 20. If one painting went for $12 million, this thing might go for $20 million.
Where would someone even keep it, though?
Right. Well, if you got a big enough estate, I mean, you throw it out back, and I don't know. Throw
it out. Nice subway car out back. It's
out by the pool, a pool house or something.
Yeah.
So the London subway could have put it on exhibit somewhere, charge people, I don't know, 10, 20 quid to get in and see it. But here's what happened. The guys who cleaned the subway cars came and wiped it all off and basically got rid of all this artwork, this graffiti. They thought it was some random graffiti by a random person on the subway. So they wiped it off. I mean, tens of millions.
Sad.
Dollars worth of artwork were wiped off by some maintenance guy, which, and the guy probably felt good about himself getting home at the end of a hard day of work cleaning up the subway cars. And then they said, "You know what you just wiped off there?
You just ruined."
That could be your little Greenspan moment for some of these equity prices.
not a bunny biting through a Greenspan book, but rather someone washing off a mural of rats for the virus in a subway.
Yeah.
Mike, we actually got a good one on Twitter, though, from Ben Emmons, who has been on the podcast before. And I have to point it out. It's kind of hilarious. He actually ripped one out of your playbook, and he looked at NIOD on the Bloomberg Terminal, which you like to do.
Best function on the terminal. It's worth the subscription price alone for NIOD. Yeah, it's all the oddest stories from around the world.
So just listen to this headline. It's "Bad Breath offers a rare payoff in Listerine royalties stake sale." And I'll just read you one of the paragraphs. Basically, it says bids are being taken through, this was past Tuesday, on a share of royalties backed by Listerine mouthwash sales. They stem from contracts signed 140 years ago by its inventor and still cited in business law classes that require the maker, who's currently Johnson & Johnson, to pay shareholders in perpetuity. So basically, as long as people are buying Listerine, they have to pay out these bond coupons in perpetuity forever.
Bad breath bonds. I love it.
Although with these
in the lockdown and quarantine world we're in, who cares about their breath, about fresh breath? Maybe this, you could short those Listerine bonds.
I have not bought any Listerine through this quarantine. To be honest,
you know what? I'm going to hand it to Ben Emmons. I'm going to give him the win for this week's craziest thing. That's pretty good.
Great contributions this time around. But seriously, David, we are so appreciative of you waking up so early to join us on the podcast. So, David Adams, it was so great having you on the show this week.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek, Mike is at Reganonymous, and you can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. Also, a special thank you to Charlie Pellett of Bloomberg Radio and the voice of the New York City subway system. What Goes Up is produced by Jordan Gaspore, The head of Bloomberg Podcast is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.